No.
Okay, welcome to this seminar. Just on behalf of the Muslim Studies Subcommittee, although subcommittee don't exist. Welcome on behalf of the South Asian Studies, Committee on South Asian Studies. It's really a pleasure for me to introduce to you today our guest speaker, Mr. Shamsur Rahman Farooqi, a dear friend, and before being a friend, he's always been a person whom I've greatly respected and admired. He is not teaching at any university in India, which goes well in his favor, perhaps. Not in any Urdu department, but he has done human service, you may say, to Urdu literature. It is to him the primarily whatever is alive and new and exciting in contemporary Urdu literature in India. He has helped so many writers to present their new work through his journal, Shakun. He has helped them clarify for themselves literary ideas, issues of dealing with tradition and innovation, at the understanding of their literary heritage through his vast amount of his literary criticism. He has published a number of books, volumes of essays, dealing with specific genres in some cases, dealing with specific literary critical issues, and very exciting for many of us has been his work on Ghalib, which began in a sort of offhand manner for him, by simply he started writing commentary on one couplet of Ghalib in each of the issues of his magazine, which incidentally is called Shabkhun, which perhaps gives an idea of the nature of the intentions behind the magazine. It means literally means sort of a night raid, but there must be some good English equivalent for it.
I'm afraid not.
No.
I'm afraid not.
Night raid is literally
by surprise.
You know, it's a raid,
two elements.
A surprise raid at night in the enemy's camp, where you go around cutting off the all the pegs of the tents and the tents fall over the head and they jump in and they both
do your mayhem.
So something of that, something but night mayhem. Yes, but not in rap. So that was some of it. But his work on Ghalib, that as I was mentioning, he started doing that, and that it went on for what, about 10 years? 20 years, and
off and on, but yes.
Off and on, and now it has finally come out in book form. In the meantime, he started another major enterprise. That was a recovery of the greatness of Mir, Taqi Mir, which who is definitely in many ways perhaps Urdu's greatest poet in the genre of Ghazal, which some people would say is of course at the heart of Urdu poetry. He's started writing commentary on Mir Taqi Mir's verses, and first volume of it has just come out, and I think the projected work will run to more than three volumes, and extremely interesting. In the meantime, as if that was not enough, by the way, he earns his living as working in the postal department of the Government of India. He has a high position in the postal services. In the meantime, he started doing something which has not been done in recent memory, and that is reading the dastans, Urdu dastans, and which is just enormous number of books, each running to several 1100, 1200, 1500 pages. And one dastan cycle, the largest of the dastan cycle, runs to about 46 volumes. And I think, so how many have you read now?
40.
So six more to go. And one of which has not yet been found, so let me stop you for a while. But there are other dastan cycles. So, I mean, at least in recent memory, nobody had done that. So he is doing that, and we hope to have his results of his investigation in that transaction. It would be absolutely a remarkable achievement. Then, in another thing, which brings us to the subject of the talk today, was he started doing something which had often been mentioned by people, but never undertaken, which was of extremely critical nature for Urdu literature, was the recovery of the old poetics. What has been written in the 20th century about Urdu poetry was written after all sort of things had taken place under the impact of the colonial state and the ideas of reform and education and setting up a canon and using literature for educational purposes and so forth, where all the notions about what was the poet's art, what were the poets trying to do, what made a particular puzzle more significant for those poets, recovery of those ideas by doing a kind of archaeology on those taskiras and poets, digging out various couplets and trying to see how we can work back from the certain ideas that they mention in their verses or the terms that they use in taskiras literature, and try to see what was mani afreen, what is khayal bandi, and such things. And that is extremely exciting work for me. So now that's why when he was coming to Chicago, I asked him to speak on this topic of the concept of the new in classical.
Thank you, Chaudhary Thak. I'm very glad to be here, and after a number of years, I don't think anyone except Norman maybe would remember that I came here in 1977 or 78 maybe. And back in Chicago, bearding the lion in his den again. And I should thank him for all the good words that he has said about me. Undoubtedly, the thing that I am trying to do has a certain amount of significance, and I hope some of it will emerge now from my talk, which is more or less a tentative kind of thing, and it's a part of a big enterprise of which briefly Naeem has mentioned. The idea is to reconstruct those views about poetry which the classical Urdu poets had, and especially those Urdu poets who came into the forefront in Delhi in the early 18th century, and some sort of a new tradition was established, or some sort of a new activity was begun. And I have a different theory from what generally has been propounded by literary historiographers in Urdu about that new development, but I won't mention it now. The focus at present of my study is what happened around that time, what kind of ideas emerged, and how they affected the making of poems. The title here is Weeping a Flood of Tears, then in quotes, make it new, which is somewhat tongue-in-cheek because, as you might recall, this is from Ezra Pound, who described assiduously and insistently for the English poets of his time the practice of writing new poems, getting away from what he described as the Edwardian tradition. Lacking a living tradition, a continuous tradition, the English poet had to think in these terms, had to think in terms of cutting away and cutting apart from the contemporary literary activity in order to set up a new model of poems. And because the concept of tradition actually involved a certain kind of continuity and also on some level a hand-to-hand transmission, person-to-person transmission, which didn't happen in the West, especially in English poetry. At least it didn't happen, after the 15th or 16th century. The great Urdu critic Muhammad Hasan Askari once, I remember, he made fun of Muriel Bradbrook, the great scholar of Elizabethan literature, because she talked about the tradition of Shakespeare and the tradition of Ben Jonson and the tradition of John Donne and so forth, and said, look, these people do not even know what a tradition is, as if every individual sets up his own tradition. In fact, traditions are set up by a community and they are more or less sub rosa. They happen by themselves and then they are communicated. So when I say make it new, it's not in that sense. But I am setting up a different kind of model. Not setting up really, I am trying to explicate a different kind of model. This model really involves an assumption that subjects for poetry are already given by other poets, by the previous practitioners, and by also other practitioners in the same time. It is something like an ongoing activity all the time. And poetry was viewed as something synchronic rather than diachronic. And any poet could be appealed to, any poet could be taken up as an authority or could be challenged, whether past or present. Some new things happened in Urdu, which I'll come to in a minute, but before I come to those things, I would like just to sort of say that this concept that poems are about subjects, are about themes and topics. I mean, I'm using these words in a very loose way, because I don't really have a proper word for what we call mazmoon and what the ancient Iranians and the ancient Arabs called mani, which I'll come to in a minute. Very, very sort of, in a very general way, we would say there are certain topoi or certain topics or certain themes. So poems are made from themes. You, a theme is given to you, and you try to improve upon that theme, refine it, for example, in two or three ways. You could, for example, put that theme in a new perspective, or you could add a new dimension to it, or maybe you could just find a new theme entirely to replace the old theme, but both the themes should have some connections, some sort of interlocking arrangement. All this is important in the context of the idea of originality in literature, in poetry particularly, which has been an important concept in the West, and of which, of course, Ezra Pound was only one of the exponents. That poets should be original. Poets should, like Sir Philip Sidney, I dip into my pen into my heart and I write. So poems should be from the heart, and each person is individual, and therefore each poem should have a certain kind of personality to it, which should be individual to the poet or to the poem. All that is known in the West in regard to influences or in regard to echoes and borrowing from other poets. We have the concept of plagiarism, that a poet sort of, or somebody borrows directly and shamelessly, steals something from somebody else, and he is looked down upon in the modern context as a plagiarist, a term which we don't use for Shakespeare, for example, because we know that he was working in a different tradition. To a certain extent, he had a living tradition where you could work upon other people's models. But otherwise, in the modern literary context, we look down upon a person who borrows from somebody else and we call him a plagiarist. When T.S. Eliot brought out his poem, The Wasteland. And he was at some pains to point out that he has made use of a variety of allusions to other poets in the past and also poets around him. And it was considered to be an important literary activity, that here is a poet who has been able to reach outside of himself to other traditions or to other times, other places, and has made use of their images or their words or their ideas in his own poems, sort of appropriating them for himself, and thus being able to sort of transit immediately from present to past, from A to B, from one place to another. And the pity of it is that also in my tradition this was considered to be an important achievement. In fact, after we read T.S. Eliot somewhat in school, we means my predecessors and my seniors and older people, they also were at pains to describe in certain cases that yes, in excess poetry also there are echoes and allusions. In fact, the late lamented Professor Karimuddin Ahmad, who was an incessant and tireless westernizer, he wrote a book about his own father's poems and also about his own poems. In both the books, the book about his poems of course came out under the name of somebody else, but anyway it is clear that he wrote it, because the kind of allusions that were, so he picked up each and every line. This line comes from Wordsworth such and such poem, this word comes from Kathleen Rain, this particular image comes from Dante, and so on. So each and every word and phrase he was at pains to point out had been borrowed from somewhere. And he made us, I mean, he believed himself, of course, and tried to make us believe that he was working in the tradition of T.S. Eliot, mind the word tradition. Actually, in our culture, where poetry, as I said, was largely synchronic, every poet was present all the time, and you could appeal to him or could challenge him. Where there was an immediately oral transmission of poetry from poet to the audience and back and forth, there were as many as five categories of influence that were identified. I don't know if Hashmat will confirm whether it was in Persian too. I have not seen it in Persian, so maybe it is there, but I don't know. Anyway, the first and foremost, which has been discussed by the ancient Iranian critics, and particularly Shamsi Qaisi Razi, who gives a different sort of, a big list of categories of sarqa, which is of course simple plagiarism, thieving, where the poet borrows an image or a theme, I should say theme because there is sort of, which covers the term mazmoon, and doesn't do anything to it. He just borrows it and uses it. I mean, it's a simple appropriation, or I would in Indian English call misappropriation. He will just make use of it, wouldn't improve upon it. Sarqa. Then there was tawarud, which was something like coincidence happening at the same time. That is, I do not know that Naeem already has written this, or this mazmoon, or this particular way of this mazmoon, and I, without knowing it, by chance, I do the same thing. Which of course is very hard to prove, but well, it was a category there. Then they had a third category, which they called iqtibas, that is allusion, quotation. That you could lift a word, or a phrase, or a tarkib from somebody else, and there was no question of you being blamed for being a chore, or being a thief, because the audience was supposed to know that you are borrowing from Hafiz, for example, or from Jami, or whoever. So iqtibas, that you lifted an image or a phrase or an important telling word, for example, and used it to your own purposes. So there was iqtibas. And then there was tarjama, translation. That you can lift a whole line, for example, from Arabic or Persian and put it into Urdu, or from Arabic into Persian, and so forth. And here again, it was well known, it's supposed to be well known to the audience that this was a translation from somebody else. And lastly, jawab, that you make a response, that okay, you have done this, now here is my version of it, I'll improve upon it. So there were these five categories there. So when you think in terms of making it new, you first of all have to think which category the poet is sort of is to be placed in, whether he is doing a simple sarqa or he is sort of excerpting something from somebody else, or he is translating directly, or he is, it's just a happenstance, or maybe he is responding, he is making a counterclaim. All this was possible, as I said, because there was a concept of given themes. Now this is a very bad, as I said, a very bad word to use, because theme or subject or topic really doesn't cover the entire concept of the thing. I'll come to it in a minute. But I am translating mazmoon, for example, which is the word used by the Urdu sort of classical poets, which corresponds to mani, as used by the Arab and the Iranian theoreticians, and also even by Ibn Sina. Ibn Sina used mani in the sense of idea, and surat in the sense of form. And for example, now Jurjani, writing in Aswar al-Balaghat in the 10th century, devotes a big part of his book to discussing different poets using the same mani in different ways. So obviously he's talking about mazmoon, about the theme. And similarly, we have Shamsa Kaiser Razi talking about mani, which means the theme, the subject. And Amir Nasrul Mamali also talking about mani, the famous formulation that poems make small monies big and big monies are small. So, which was what they were considered to be the topic, what the poem is about. Our poetics, that is the Urdu poetics, seems to have developed the other thing, that is the an opposition between mani and mazmoon, which I'll come to in a minute. The definition of mazmoon or theme, therefore, would be a well-known formulation, which could be an image, which could be a statement about the universe, which could be an impression about a certain fact, and then from where follow other similar ideas. Basically, the mazmoon or the mani is a metaphorical statement. And here again an interesting development sort of takes place. Western ideas about poetry, especially after the Russian formalists and the structuralists, are generally in favor of saying, like Roman Jakobson, that metaphor is the language of poetry, and metonymy is the language of say prose fiction, for example. I mean any other creative writing, but I mean for poetry the main domain is metaphor, and for non-poetry but other creative activity the main domain is metonymy, which again has been sort of subverted by this concept of mazmoon. Because what happens here is, as you know very well, in metaphor you substitute a thing for another thing. The metaphor is basically sort of syntagmatic. Now, for example, you say, let's say, love. Now, love, the sorrow of love, the pain of love, from which you come to weeping, because the stronger the sorrow, the feeling of love, the weeping could be either because of sorrow or because of the impact of the feeling of love on you, the experience of love on you. Then from weeping we come to, now from here we start displacement, because weeping actually is a metaphor for pain. Now since somebody has experienced pain because they have experienced love, so they weep, which is okay. Now from here you start contiguity rather than substitution. Weeping, tears, chashm, that is eye, and chashma, the stream. So from tears you go to stream, and from stream you go to river, then you go to flood, then you go to the ocean, then you go to the sky, because the ocean forms clouds, and then you go to the clouds, you go down to rain, and from rain you go down to gardens, to forests. So you can see how they are interlocking, yet actually they are occurring because they are steps taken by the poet's imagination or somebody's imagination somewhere. Along a line of contiguities, not a line of substitutions. From this, 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 and so on. So that's how each mazmoon, which is basically metaphorical, is actually functioning on a scale of contiguities. Like here, for example, we will discuss this weeping of Lord appears in a minute. As I said, love is a powerful experience, which in itself is powerful enough to cause a person to weep. And of course, then there is a question of unsuccess in love, or the beloved going away, or the beloved not responding, and so forth. So both ways, there is sorrow and powerful emotion. So weeping, and then weeping copiously, because the deeper the feeling, the deeper the experience of love, or the experience of pain, the bigger the weeping. And then from weeping, as I said, you go on to other things, scream and so on. Now, one of the ironies of my culture has been that when westernization took place, it put us on the defensive, and even those people, in fact, who were well qualified to withstand the influence of westernization. And except perhaps Iqbal, there is no one in modern India, at least in my culture, there is Indo-Muslim culture, whom I can think of as a person who could withstand the ceaseless pressure of westernization and stand up in his own right as an individual, as a person, as representing a culture. Other people, those people who were important in my literary theory of the late 19th century and early 20th century, they simply succumbed. Even those people who were highly qualified to withstand the pressure, I say. For example, I was trying to say was a man like Shibli Nomani. Now Shibli, as we all must be sort of must have heard his name, I'm sure. He was practically bilingual in Urdu and Persian, and he knew a lot of Arabic. He knew some French also. He was a historian, he was a logician, he was a philosopher, he was a literary critic. He wrote a five-volume history of Persian literature called Sher-ul Azam, Persian poetry, which is today read more often for the beautiful examples that he has quoted. His taste was so impeccable that he found almost always the best of the poet whom we were discussing. And so forth. But so now, such a person, one would have expected to believe to sort of have been able to stand in front of the Western ideas about poetry, and at least would have made a statement of his own, which I think he tries to do. But the way, I mean, he retreats is exemplified by a statement of his who says, "Well, what a pity it is that mazmoons used to be simple and direct and straightforward in the early times when poetry was young. But as poetry becomes older and poets become less and less creative, they have to produce more and more complexities in the mazmoons. They make them more and more complicated, they become more and more metaphorical, they become more and more unrealistic and so forth." Which in fact is quite, I mean, just a thing. I mean, becoming complicated over time, becoming complex over time, is the function of the mazmoon. Because saying that I wept copiously is not enough. You have to say more about it. And that's how you make it new. So, naturally, you either add another observation to it, or you import some other contiguity, or you look at it from a different point of view, or you introduce some new dimension of time or space or something. So, I mean, here is Shibli lamenting the fact that what a pity it is in India the Indian Persian poets made things more and more complex, and poetry became very, very cerebral, and poetry became very, very unrealistic and so on, because the simple mazmoons had already been exhausted by the great poets. So that's how, you see, this was the response of a classic 19th century Indian Urdu scholar, whereas the correct response should have been that we have found a different way of making poems, and it is to our credit that that different way of making poems can sustain itself over centuries. Now just to another half an hour or so.
Go ahead.
Acha. Just by way of footnote, how this mazmoon and mani things come into the picture. As I've just mentioned to you, the ancient Arabs and the ancient Iranians both, they do not mention money in the sense of meaning. I mean, at least in the theoretical statements about poetry, I'm sure Hasan will know more, but this is what I understand about. They mention money in the sense of theme, of mazmoon. Poems should have more meanings than they apparently have on the surface. Or a poem should mean two or three things at the same time. Or the poem should be saying something differently from what it seems to say. I mean, all those formulations which have now become fashionable thanks to Jacques Derrida and his children, well, they were known to us, you see, over the centuries. And in fact, some of them were so obvious to us that we didn't even put them down on paper. So, well, what happens is that by about the 17th century, you find that poets are discussing using the word mazmoon also, and separately from mani. That is now in India, I mean, they are making a distinction that while mazmoon is something which is the poem, what is the poem about? What is the that is the mazmoon, that is the theme or the mani in the ancient terminology. And mani is what does the poem mean? What does the poem say? For example, the mazmoon is, what is the poem about? The poem is about weeping. What kind of weeping? Copious weeping. How copious? Like a stream. But what does the poem say? Is something quite different. Because the poem's meaning, you see, is more than what the poem is about. So by the 17th century, and I like to think that this was a development which took place in Indo-Iranian and Indo-Muslim poetics as a result of the Sanskrit connection. Because, as you must be very well aware, the Sabke Hindi poetry in Persian, it may have evolved elsewhere, I'm not going into the history of it, but it certainly came to its full fruition and flower in India in the 17th century. And it has certain features and characteristics which are not to be found in the mainline Iranian poetry in Persian. So connections were being established, because we know that, for example, Khusrau, who is perhaps the only Indian Persian poet whom the Iranians recognize as a genuine, truly Persian voice, he is before the Sabke Hindi connection, and his poetry therefore is more mainline Iranian. But by the time we are in the 17th century, a different kind of poetry is being written. And it could be just an accident of history, but we know that Jagannath, the last important Sanskrit theoretician about poetry, was in the court of Shah Jahan. In fact, his title... not in the sense of mazmoon, but he talks about mani ye nazuk, ishrate ma nazuk khayala, halali nastubas. So he talks about nazuk khayali and mani as against just what a poem is what a poem means. Then of course by the 18th century we find that all Urdu poets are making statements about poetry, and in fact they seem to be conscious that they have done something new. And so every important poet from the 18th century to the middle of the 19th century makes certain statements about the nature of poems. And from where, as Naeem said, it's a kind of an archaeological enterprise, that you go back to the poems and read them, and you extract those statements about the nature of poetry and try to match them with the poems or with whatever they have said elsewhere. So this is an exercise in mazmoon afrini, as against mani afrini. That is, mani afrini would be where a mazmoon need not necessarily be new, or mazmoon need not necessarily have been given a new direction or dimension, but the poem seems to say, or poem in fact does say, more than what it seems to say, or the poem says more than one thing at the same time. Whereas in mazmoon afrini, you have a given mazmoon, a given theme, on which you play by adding some new dimension of observation or of experience. So here, Weeping a Flood of Tears, by way of background, I give you two shares, one from Khusrau and one from Hafiz, to represent the mainline Iranian sort of style of, I will not be able to read these shares in the true Iranian style. I will read them only in the Indian style, because that's all that I know about, I mean, reading Persian. You have the translations in front of them. Not very good, but they're just sort of adequate. سیلاب سرشکز غم ہجران تو ہم دوش تا دوش بود امروز ببالا سر آمد. You know, you have the English here in front of you. There are two interesting things happening here. One is that there is a word play on the word dosh, which in the first misra means yesterday, and the second misra it means shoulder. So a word play on dosh, and a kinaya about the speed of the flood, how fast it rose. He doesn't say how fast it rose. He only says that last year, last night was so much, and this morning it was so much. So it's a flood of tears, and the flood is about to drown him, and the flood rose very fast over the night. And of course then all those connotations about the night and lamentation and so forth, and which we need not go into, but you can see that already possibilities are being explored by the poet, although as early as say the middle of the 13th century. And then Hafiz, almost 70 years or more later, Chanda giristam ki harakas ke barguzasht azdida am judid rawan guft inche juust. Now here, as you can see, two things have happened to the mazmoon. One is that there are two parties now. In the other share of Khusrau's, the two parties, one party of course was the beloved who is in any case a constant factor. Here there are two active parties. One is the poet or the protagonist who is weeping, and the other is the other person, the other, who doesn't even know that this is a flood of tears. So he asks, what river is this? So the other is the true other, because he or she is not aware of the sorrow of love, does not recognize or understand that people weep a flood of tears and rivers flow from them. And so a new kind of equation is being set up between about the experience of weeping, that there are people who weep, there are people who are sad, and there are people who do not even know what sadness is, who are so naive or so uninformed or whatever, or who lack dardmandi so much that they have to ask. And of course by kinaya, the other thing, that he wept so much that a whole river began to flow. So you can see that the river, the flowing of the river takes on a secondary position. It's not the most important thing. So the mazmoon has been used for saying something else. So this I give you by way of a background as to what kind of things were already possible as early in the development of the mazmoon as the 13th, 14th centuries. And we now come into the 18th century, the middle of it, because that's perhaps the most fruitful period of Urdu literary history, the 18th century, and especially the second half of the 18th century. So I have in fact chosen some shares only from that period, with a view to giving you the extent of invention that was possible and that the poets could achieve. So we have Khan-e Arzu, who was basically a Persian scholar, lexicographer, poet. By his time, by the end of his time more or less, Urdu had become an important literary medium. So we have Khan-e Arzu also practicing Urdu. Daryaye ashq apna jab sar ba auj mare toofan-e nooh baitha goshe mein mauj mare. Brian, do you have a spare copy of the writer somewhere? Acha. So here, of course, you can see that there is an obvious new thing added, which is the deluge, Noah's flood. But in addition to that, some other things are also happening. I mean, in itself, this itself would have been an important contribution to add a new sort of a new dimension by mentioning the flood of Noah. But two other things have happened here. One is that Sarb Auj Mare. Now, which is a translation from the Persian idiom, and which means when it is intent upon rising, or when it desires to rise. So it's not really that the river of my tears has actually arisen. It's just in the act of rising. And of course, with sar and auj, you can see the wordplay here, because sar is the top of the body and auj means height, so there is a wordplay already set up there. Then similarly, mauj marna, is again a very ambiguous kind of, I mean, sort of, it's rather polyvalent, because it means to give yourself to expressing joy abundantly, in gay abhana, and it also means to surge up and down, to surge to and fro, like the tides are being and flowing. So you can see that the deluge in one interpretation or in one meaning, it is a small part of the whole system. And in another meaning, it seems that the deluge is seeing itself fulfilled. When the deluge sees my flood of tears, it sees itself fulfilled. That's why it is Moj Marnya. It's feeling that expressing itself in great abada. So you can see how the mazmoon has been added on to. While the of course the subtlety of Hafiz has not been achieved, because Hafiz has set up two worlds. One world is the world of the lover or the protagonist, and the other world is the other world, sort of, so to speak. But the mazmoon itself has been added to. While in the case of Hafiz there was a bit of Mani Afrini, because he has added a new concept there. In terms of simple mazmoon Afrini, the Khane Arzu Sher, who is certainly a very interesting one. Then Ashraf Ali Khan Fogan, same age group, he died in Murshidabad, Dhaka. This could be from Murshidabad, I don't know, because this has an interesting sort of local touch in it. Itna wafoor khush nahi aata hai ashq ka, alam ko mat dubo yo ae chashme tar kahin. Now this is normally people believe that Urdu poetry is full of overstatements, that it's the poetry which always believes in exaggeration. Well, which is true, largely speaking, because after all, mazmoons are based on exaggeration, which is a kind of metaphor. But in the second half of the 18th century, some of the major poets and also some of the minor ones like Fogan have a certain panache, a certain penchant for understatement. Like here, I don't like it. Too much weeping. I don't like it. So you can see that apart from the fact that the kinaya has been already established, a kinaya is a statement where you make you say something from which another statement can be inferred. That is kinaya. That is, suppose you say the sun rose. Now the kinaya is that it was morning, which is not there anywhere at all. So a kinaya is a statement from which you can infer a different statement altogether. So here the kinaya is that the eyes are capable of a certain kind of a food, a certain kind of flooding, a certain kind of muchness, plenitude. And the eyes are a different agent. And from here you see the new mazmoon comes in, that I am a different agent, the person, the protagonist, and my eyes are a different agent. Partly in my control, partly not in my control, and so I shout and say, I don't like it, there's too much of weeping here. And of course then the last kinaya, that the eye is capable of weeping to so much so as to drown out the whole world. Then Sauda, of course a greater name and a greater poet, somewhat uncharacteristic here. I mean, you see, if you study the mazmoons the way I am trying to do, you will find that many of these stereotypes of Urdu poetry will be breaking in front of you all the time. Like Saran Sauda has been described in Urdu criticism mostly as a poet of hyperbole in introvert kind of poetry, a person given over to satire and irony and anger and so forth. And so another aspect of his poetry, which is this kind of mainline Ghazal poetry, has generally been ignored. So here we have, Saavan ke badalon ki tarah se bhare huye, ye wo nayan hai jinse ki jungle hare huye. So you can see the journey of the thought of the eyes, chashma, then stream, then flood, then ocean, from ocean to clouds, and again to rain. And then what has not been said here, there are two things. One is that the clouds of the Saavan, of the rainy season, Bhare hue. Now, bhare hue has two senses. One is to be full of passion. Bhara baitha hun. That is, I am full of passion, full of anger, full of a desire to express myself, something wants to come out of myself. And of course, full, overflowing. So both ways it is there. That the eyes are bhara hua in the sense that they are strongly full of a desire to express themselves, to come out openly. And then lastly, after all, the saman doesn't be there all the time, it goes away. So there is a hint here that some time will come when the eyes also will be dry. After the jungle has been made hara, it has been made green, maybe then the eyes will become dry. Then, Mir, one of the greatest of them all, as you can see, this share comes from about the same time as Saudas. The dates before, after the shares are the dates, probable dates of composition, and dates in front of the names are the dates of the age. Kinnindon ab tu soti hai ay chashme giriya naak, mishgaan to khol, shahar ko sailab le gaya. Now here, the first thing to note is the mode, the grammatical mode that is being used. Kin neendon, what kind of sleep are you sleeping? Who? Oh, you eyes who are full of tears. So an interrogative and then a vocative. Then again, mishgaan to khol. Again, an imperative. Open your eyelids. Open your look up. What is happening? And then the last is a statement. Now this is I don't know whether this distinction was developed by the Iranians also. I have much will know better than I do. In our kind of poetics, there are two kinds of statements. One we call inshaiya. That's a statement which is not falsifiable. That's all interrogatives, all imperatives, all subjunctives, all and so forth. They're all, you can't say whether, suppose I say, am I in Chicago? Now the answer could be yes or no, but this statement couldn't be falsified. But I am in Chicago, this can be falsified. In theory, you can say whether you're not. So statements which can be falsified are known as khabariya, affirmative, informative. And those which can be falsified are known as inshaiya. And since the possibility of meaning is greater in inshaiya, so inshaiya is per se superior to khabariya. Because of the various possibilities of interrogatives possible, and the various kinds of vocatives possible, and various kinds of meaning. So here, for example, you can see that this whole shair consists of four pieces. Three of them are inshaiya. Kin neendo, ab tu soti hai, ae chashme giriya naak. Mishga to khol, and then the last comes in affirmative, shahar ko sailab le gaya. Of course, another interesting linguistically or in terms of usage, he has used a new sort of combination, giriya naak, because naak, which is a suffix in Urdu and Persian meaning full of, is generally not used for this kind of noun, like you use it for abstract noun, like say you can say khauf naak, dard naak and so forth. So he has used a certain amount of novelty or a newness is here in giriya naak. And again, as you can see, the treatment wise, he is like Ashraf Ali Khan Foghan, that the eyes are a different agent and the protagonist, the speaker, is another agent. And the beauty of meaning is that the eyes, when one weeps, the eyes are not open really. I mean, after all, because the eyelids are heavy, so the heavy eyelids and the weeping, which itself causes sight to disappear, are being described as sleeping. That you are not aware of what you have done, the kind of devastation. So you see here, I mean, a physical fact, the fact of the eyes being covered by the eyelids and by the eyelashes and by the tears also, and thus there are three layers of curtains which don't make the eye able to see, which has been ironically described as sleeping. But you are asleep, you don't even know what you are doing. How much time, Chaudhary? Should I go over the other remaining six shares, or should I?
Yes, why not? You go ahead.
Okay, okay. 10 minutes नहीं होगा.
No,
I can omit this.
I always ask an interesting question. Go ahead.
अच्छा, okay. Now, in fact, these shares I chose with some care, so they are not purely at random, as you will see now. अब चश्मे गिरिया पैमा सरफा है क्या जहां का सैलाब खून से तेरे जलथल तो भर चुका है. Now Qayyim, as you must be aware, was a poet with a very high reputation in his time, and unfortunately the first important literary history of Urdu poetry, namely Ab-e-Hayat in 1880, mentioned him only in parenthesis, in a footnote, although he did say, God bless him, he did say that his Qayyim Chandpuri's best poems are pehlu marti hain with me, they're as good as me's poems are. Yet he didn't even quote a single one of them. So Qayyim went through a period of you can say silence, and he is only now coming up into prominence. Anyway, so you can see here that we have Giriya Naak in Mir, and our Qayyim gives a reply in using Giriya Paima. Now Paima, of course, again here the same kind of thing is happening, that he is using, he is transferring a standard usage to a non-standard one, because Paimudan, to measure, from which we have Badiya Paima, there is a person who measures, that is, who traverses through and through a wilderness and so on, but he is using Giriya Paima. So now weeping becomes an ocean which this person is, the eyes are measuring out, which are they are traversing, they are traveling through. Then he says, "Sarfa hai kya jahan ka." Now, sarfa is a very interesting word. It's full of various kinds of meanings. I mean, it's kind of a word which you can use in two or three meanings, and each of them mutually exclusive. Husbandry, economy, or expenditure, wasteful expenditure, use. So all the meanings are there, and you can see that because he is using, again using inshaya, sarfa hai kya jahan ka, so you can have all those meanings. What do you intend to do with the world? What use the world is now? You have already destroyed the world completely, and so forth. Sailab khun se tere jalthal to bhar chuka hai. And in the second misra, you are in for a little shock, because in the first misra you are only told about Giriya Paima, that the eye is Giriya Paima, and you anticipate something about more about tears, for example, and he slips in a verse, Sailab khun, the flood of which is now, I mean the flood of tears of blood. So he sets up an expectation which he destroys by using a more powerful word. Mir Hasan, who is an important Ghazal poet and also known for his Masnavi, but I put this share here, peace be on him and God forgive me for this, but just to set up a dichotomy, that a good word or a good phrase by itself doesn't help a poem. Like here he has used Giriya Naak, obviously borrowed from Mir, but he hasn't done much to it, as you can see. उस चश्मे गिरिया नाक में आलम डुबो दिया जिधर गई उधर को ये तूफान ले गई. So I mean, good enough, which is good statement, but the Giriya Naak, the possibilities which Mir has exploited in terms of sound and in terms of meaning, have not been exploited here. And the share, in fact, the only way the share is memorable is because of Giriya Naak. And if you hadn't known Mir already previously, you would have said, ha, what a nice turn of phrase, Giriya Naak. Now, the last four I give you by way of a certain kind of comparison as well as example. Like the number 9 I give you because of the possibilities of Mani Afrini and how a poet can exploit them, particularly a poet like Mir, who is equally good in Maghnoon Afrini and equally good in something which is called Kaifiyat, which meant briefly something like an appeal to the emotions directly in such a way that the meaning of the poem really is not important. In fact, you don't even think about the meaning, but you... So that was Kaifiyat. So this is the share of all three combined, Mani Afrini, Mazmoon Afrini, and Kaifiyat. Har gul zameen ya ki rone hi ki jagah thi manind abr harja main zar zar roya. Now, gulzami is a very interesting word, because gulzami actually only means plot of land, piece of land, parcel of land. But you may read it literally also. So gulzami is a land of flowers, a garden therefore. And then you can see that in both senses, the entire sher follows from gul and zameen. Because then rona, which is like tears, then jaga, which is placed like zameen, then abr, of course, which is already raining, zar, and roya, and ja, of course, meaning jaga again. So the entire sher follows from the first two words, namely har gul zameen. So this is the kind of munasibat of which Mir was very fond. In fact, of which every poet has to be fond if he has to be a good poet. Mir is par excellence the poet of munasibat, that he follow the word that follow. The opening word that all words that follow, they somehow are connected in some sense, either in the sense of sound or sense of meaning or association and so forth. So this yaki, again you see now you can see the ambiguity, the play of ambiguity. Yaki means where? This world as a whole, this universe as a whole, this place where I am now, Delhi or Lucknow, or wherever I am, or my home. Because if it is my home, then in fact because this is again a well-known theme, to be a traveler in your own home, Safar dar vatan, which is also a Sufistic formulation and has different connotations. But its literal sense also has been used by Urdu poets very often to show their alienation or their loneliness or whatever. So if it is his home, then in that case his home becomes a universe in its own right. And maninde abraharja, mazar zar roya. So it was, he doesn't explain to you why was the world or this place, yaan, a place of weeping. Because other people were weeping, maybe, or because it was all devastated, or because he could see more, he could see the rot that had set in, other people couldn't see it, or that he knew that he would be a part of it tomorrow. I mean, whatever. You can go on building any possibilities, because and the beauty is that there is no apparent ambiguity in the poem. Whereas Ghalib, for example, perhaps an equally great poet, or at least slightly smaller, he makes you aware. He will catch you by the scruff of your neck and say, look, here is something ambiguous, here is something meaningful, come on, think about it. He is a poet who grabs you intellectually and through his imagery or through his whatever. Mir is a kind of poet who will stab you in the back. You wouldn't even know what he has done. Because I can tell you that this, I have read the Kulliyat of Mir, I don't know how many times, 30 times, I don't know. And it was only when I was developing this series of shares that this share occurred to me. Otherwise, it hasn't occurred to me at all. Because he is so full of this kind of poetry, which is simple, apparently simple, and from where comes his eternal reputation in classrooms of his simplicity and his directness and his whatever.
Weepiness.
Okay, now the last three are in kind of a tour de force, or no, sorry, what is the word? Or whatever, you see the icing on the cake. Because I had proposed to stop at number 9. My scheme was to confine myself to the 18th century and second half, in fact, particularly. But I couldn't resist putting in Ghalib when I discovered the last one, which is from Nimal Khan Ali. So we will come to it one by one. Now the Ghalib share is considered to be, and rightly is, one of his best shares in terms of meaning, because the word Nikla, as you know, Dil mein phir griya ne ek shor uthaya Ghalib, ah, jo qatra na nikla tha, so tufaan nikla. Nikalna has two meanings, to come out, simply to come out physically, or to turn out to be. So the drop did not come out, it turned out to be a tufaan. Or the drop, or the thing which did not turn out to be even a drop, it turned out to be a typhoon, a tufaan. And then of course the clever word shor, because shor, apart from the euphony of it and all that, also means salt, saltiness, which is therefore true for both tufan, typhoon, ocean, and true for tears, but both are salty. So this kind of thing, of course, Ghalib and Mir both are masters at. That slipping in a word which has all the possible connotations, including the remote connotation known as zila, that a new angle, like here, shore, has all the meanings. The the intensity of the cloud, the intensity of the storm, the noise, and on top of that, the other meaning of shore, which is saltiness, and therefore, okay. So we all, in our goodness of heart and sincerity of admitting for Ghalib, we always believe that here is a great, great, great share of Ghalib's, and Ghalib certainly deserves to be given his, and especially when he was so young, 1821, he was just hardly 24 years old. And then in my travel through Mir, I found the old man already having done it. Aansu to dar se pee gaye, lekin wo qatra aab, ek aag tan badan mein hamare laga gaya. Out of fear, I swallowed my tears, but that little drop of tears, a little drop of water, set me on fire through and through. Okay, so I was patting myself on the back many years ago when I found this share in the Kulliyat of Mir, and yeah, here we are. The Ustad really has it last in the first word. But only recently, while leafing through some other Persian poetry, I encountered this Nimal Khan Ali, 17th century India, and I found the source for both of these. Shore mahshar shudo za su jaha gasht buland nalay ra ki manaz tar se tu pinha kardam. It became the noise, the tumult of the doomsday, and appeared from across the world somewhere, that weeping and lamentation which I had hidden for fear of you. But you can see how Mir has improved upon Nimal Khan Ali. Although Nimal Khan Ali is not a child's play, he is a major poet. And he is a poet who was an expert at exploiting the meanings of words and various kinds of zila and various kinds of wordplay. In the first place, Mir's typical ambiguity again, whereas Nimal Khan Ali clearly says that he swallowed his tears because of a fear of the beloved. Beloved's anger, that's a two, on account of your fear. She will be angry or whatever. Me only said, dar se pee gaye, I swallowed out of fear. Now what fear, he doesn't say. And so you have an infinity of possibilities, practically infinity of possibilities. Fear of for his own self, fear for the beloved, fear of the beloved's anger, fear of the beloved's ignominy, fear of the whole world being critical of him, or whatever. So in just one stroke, the great poet has been able to improve upon, certainly a great poet like Nimal Khan Ali. And then equating fire and water. Aansu to dar se pee gaye, lekin wo qatra aab, ek aag tan badan mein hamare laga gaya. In the case of Nimal Khan Ali, the image is slightly distanced from us, because the nala appears like shore mahshar, which we have to imagine only on the mental level, as Jurjani would say. And then of course we have to imagine the end of the world and all that. Whereas here, it's my own body, and it's my own fire, it's my own tears. So the equation of tears with water and fire, and then a more immediate appeal to my immediate experience. So as you can see, Ghalib in the footsteps of Mir, and me in the footsteps of Nimal Khan Ali, and you can't fault either Mir or Ghalib. But they have borrowed from Nimal Khan Ali undoubtedly. And I'm sure if I look deeper, Ashfaq Mohit perhaps can do better than I. If you look deeper, you can find somebody else from whom Nimal Khan Ali has borrowed. But you can't fault either Mir or Ghalib. They have added their own dimension to it. Now please don't ask me whether the dimension is a personal experience dimension or a personal truth dimension or some sort of philosophical whatever. These are not my concerns. I am only concerned with how the poet has used the words and what meanings I can extract from them. Whether these meanings were present in his head, whether those meanings are a part of his worldview and philosophy as such, I leave to others to decide. So briefly, this is how it is done. That you have a given set of things, and from that given set of things, you apply your creativity to it, and then you find new ways of putting the same thing over and over again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mir is doing the jawab.
I see. So we are doing a jawab here,
yes.
And not a borrowing.
No.
Yes, sure.
Well, I was very much intrigued by your remarks regarding Jagannath Pandidaraja.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility that this great work, Rasa Gangadhara, may have played some role in the development of his poetry after the middle of the 17th century. Well, I don't know how to phrase my question except to say that this is an extremely difficult text, Rasagangadhara, and I think some of the great poetic insight in that text really doesn't appear in too much of Jagannath's poetry itself, Bhamini Vilasa. And what I'm really interested in is what evidence you might have that any of this complex, highly specialized Sanskrit Alankarika material may have been available to Urdu poets, may have been accessible to Urdu poets. Is it just a surmise, or do you see some sort of intellectual interaction at the court of Shah Jahan or later among Sanskrit poeticians and Urdu poets?
Well, at present, it's purely a guesswork of mine, because many of these 18th century Urdu poets had some intimacy with these things. And since this new thing seems to be happening only around that time when Jagannath was active, I am making an inspired or an uninspired or rather a mad leap into this. Then whether Jagannath's own poetry, which I am not really familiar with, shows any traces of his thought, it's not really relevant at all. Mm-hmm. Because, as I said in the beginning itself, that like our own poets, I have the least intention of trying to apply their own statements on their poetry. If they say that my poetry is full of this, I don't necessarily say that this also is true in the case of this poet. What I want to say is that this is what these people expected poems to be. If Mir says that my poems are many-sided, many-dimensional, tarfe rakhe hai ek sukhan char char Mir, my one statement has four sides. Of course, four here means here suggests only sort of something like indefiniteness or more. So now, whether Mir's own poetry has this kind of thing or not, I don't know. But he certainly expects the poem to be like this, a good poem to be like this, because he often, in his own prose also, he talks about tahdari, which is a word which has again become familiar nowadays through thanks to the deconstructionist layers of meaning. Well, he is very fond of saying tahdari, and he, in fact, his pet phrase for denigration is betah, that he has no layers. So, my point is that since Jagannath is active at a certain period in history, when some new things seem to be happening, and then they are happening faster in Urdu, because when Urdu becomes the medium, around that time, you see, in the 17th century, Urdu starts coming up in the north as a literary medium. It has been a literary medium in the south for many centuries before this time. But somehow, at least we have yet no knowledge of any literary text that may have been composed in the north in Urdu in the 16th century, except for one. So it seems that there was some sort of a hiatus, and literary activity in Urdu was happening in the Gujarat and then in the Deccan. In Delhi, it starts happening in the 17th century. And then it takes on a very strong sort of momentum in the early 18th century. So something must have happened. So it's only a kind of a mad, foolish guess of mine. Because, you see, I am always reminded, of course, and I don't pretend to have understood Jagannath very well. As you say, he's a very difficult man to understand. And not having Sanskrit, naturally, I'm doubly handicapped. And I can't even be sure whether I have been reading an accurate English translation at all. But whatever is there, I can see that he is talking like me today, for example. He is more interested in, he says that, well, whatever truth value, whatever meanings a poem may have, in terms of messages and all that, I'm not interested. I really want to know how well the poem is made. So that sort of thing, because when like Sai, for example, writing at the same time, when he says, Ishrate ma maniye nazuk badast avurdanast. My luxury is only to get hold of a very subtle meaning. Ishrate ma nazuk khayala rahilali nastubas. For us who are subtle thinkers, the moon of Eid is nothing but this, to get hold of a subtle meaning. So I can see that he is not saying that I have that my happiness or the apogee of my achievement would be to say something very profound in terms of philosophical import or whatever, but he is talking of subtlety of meaning more than anything else. So this thing is happening at that time. So I hope I am right, but even if I am wrong, it doesn't make my main statement wrong, which is that these poets certainly have a distinction between Mani and Mazmoon, and they are more interested in these things. I mean, they never talk about truth, about authenticity, about depth of feeling, about sincerity, about and so forth. These things are there, but I mean, they are not important for them. What is important for them is how to make poems through the material that is available to them.
Just a footnote to this question. I've always thought that Jagannath's greatest work shows something brand new in Sanskrit poetry that I think may be an influence from
the Persian. Quite right. Yes. We know that he was friendly with Abu Talib Kalim, so mm-hmm. something must have gone on there.
And though the 18th century poets may not show Urdu poets and others may not show much acquaintance with Sanskrit, they certainly were very familiar with what they call Bhaka poetry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And much of this some of the Alankara poetry was available to them through what they call Bhaka poetry.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect Khan-e-Arzu would have known some Sanskrit, because I am reading from his lexicographical yes. works. One does feel that he has an acquaintance with Sanskrit.
Yes, just a question. You have taken just one Mazmoon here, the Mazmoon of Viking.
Sure.
And its development, additions and so on, among five or six poets. Now the poets usually have many hundreds of Mazmoon,
mm-hmm,
every single one of
mm-hmm,
them.
Mm-hmm.
Now your statement, can you make it a general statement concerning all Mazmoons from poet to poet, from century to century, or it's only valid for this one or a few Mazmoons you have studied?
No, in fact, my whole thesis, you see, depends on this premise, that all Mazmoons are like that. Except that if a Mazmoon doesn't have the possibility of interlocking with other Mazmoons, then it may dry out. But otherwise, so long as the Mazmoon, if it occurs to me, for example, as a new Mazmoon for the first time in history, it still will have a fruitful life around me and after me, because other people will take it on, unless of course it does not have the merit of interlocking with other Mazmoons, which is the quality of Khayal Bandi, which is again a term which we used and we devised for describing a kind of poetry where Mazmoons were so outre that they didn't have the fertility sort of to branch out and to interlock. So I think it is true for all Mazmoons.
But I meant to say, for example, take just this one, the Mazmoon of Weeping.
Mm-hmm.
You have 6, 7, 10 lines. But in any single divan,
mm-hmm.
even from the earliest one, he before him,
mm-hmm.
is after him.
Mm-hmm.
In all of them you will find many times the Mazmoon repeated, each time in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Now it takes you in your study, will you take all these occurrences in a single divan and then the next one and the next one, like putting in a computer and go through it?
What we need is a couple of super cray computers and a team of about 20 people working on.
Right.
What I hope to achieve is to show some of the more paradigmatic Mazmoons which have been used again and again in Urdu poetry, and to show how, and of course, and try to trace the steps, you see, of contiguity from one to another. Like, for example, love, captivity. From captivity you get cage, from cage you get bird, from bird you get sky, from sky you get wings, from wings you get, you see, loss of wings, and again recaptivity, and then from captivity you get you go back to the garden and so on. So actually it's a very, very fascinating world, as you will certainly, I mean, appreciate it more than perhaps most of us. And no single individual can ever hope to trace all the Mazmoons, and in fact it's not necessary. What is important is to state the principle and show it in action in some of the more important or the more well-known Mazmoons over a certain period of time, and to show how the same, the poet's sensibilities have been acting on those Mazmoons. That should be enough, I suppose. I mean, I hope at least, I don't suppose.
Ryan? Two questions. What
has happened to Madhmun Afrini in the 20th century?
You see, the modern ghazal is still Madhmun Afrini. The only trouble is that there are no longer any given Madhmuns available. Like, you see, this Weeping, for example, or Captivity, or all those Madhmuns, except for Fayez, who used them to a certain extent with some success. Since these things fell into discredit and disrepute, they were given up by us. So now every poet tries to create his own Madhmuns. Within the basic worldview of the ghazal, which is another part of my project, to state the grammar of the ghazal, what exactly it consists of. And basically, to my mind, consists of three things. One is the world of course, the Madhmuns and Mani Afrini and other things, which are the aesthetic part of it, to put it very badly. And one is the worldview of the ghazal, that it's a static universe, nothing ever changes, everything is the same, and everything is only, you need to discuss only the essences and not individuals. That is, you don't discuss anfus but only afaq. And thirdly, that what kind of things are happening in the ghazal, who are involved in it. So, which is basically, therefore, a ghazal is a love poem, basically. And a love poem of unreaching, of unsuccess, of dissatisfaction, with the freedom for the poet to do other things also, if he or she wants, and as they have done, which again has been sanitized now, unfortunately. That all that part of the ghazal in our tradition, I mean, the themes of irreverence, themes of joking and laughter, themes of making fun of the beloved, themes of being angry at the beloved, all those have been sanitized, unfortunately, because they were considered to be bad in taste, you see, not according to Tennyson, not according to Samuel Smiles and other helps. But so that's why the modern ghazal writer is doubly handicapped. Or, in fact, the reason why the ghazal has survived is because the worldview has survived undamaged practically. Still, the world is a static universe. Things are there forever and ever. And we are talking only in terms of the afaq of things, not the anfus of things.
The second question, much briefer. I believe I've come across the term khayal afrini.
Yes.
How does that tie in with Madhmun Afrini?
Actually, you know, since these terms were being evolved, sort of refined over time, so some, for example, you will find Mani Parvari, Mani Yabi, Mani Bandi, and so forth. Even as late as Momin, for example, in 1850s, Agarche Sher Momin bhi nihayat khub kehta hai, kahan hai lek Mani Band Madhmun Yab apna sa. So instead of Mani Afrini, Mani Band. Instead of Mani Madhmun Afrini, Madhmun Yab. So Mani Yab, Khayal Parvar, and so forth, they were all being used, the many about. Gradually, by the middle of the 19th century, in fact, Momin's example is kind of a maverick example. By that time, it's well established that there are certain hierarchies also. In fact, there are, I mean, poets' statements showing that Mani Afrini is superior to Madhmun Afrini. Khayal Bandi is a different kind of thing, which is, to put it sort of uncharitably, it is Madhmun Afrini gone astray, which is a very, very, very oversimplified way of putting it. Then we have, of course, Shorangezi, or Shorish, which is roughly a very passionate statement about the universe, in which the poet himself may not be directly involved, but he makes a passionate statement about the universe and asks you to share it. And then Kaifiyat, which is a state of affairs in the poem, where the meaning may not be there, or very little meaning may be there, or the meaning may be unimportant initially. Like, for example, like Fayez. Now, if you try to explicate Fayez, you will run up against a stone wall. There's hardly any meaning in him. What he has is a lot of kaifiyat, where he moves you, he sort of fills you with emotion. So these are four or five or six, you know. And of course, some of the grammar of it, like rapt, for example, munasibat and rapt and things like that. That's why this study of the divans of the poets from the 18th century makes a very, very fascinating reading. How these terms are being used again and again. Mani and Mazmoon and Rapt and Munasibat and Shorish and Shorangezi and so on.
Other questions?
Yes.
Speaking as one who really doesn't know the literature, but interested in your broader claims of, in terms of what the nature of poetics is, and clearly in your opening comments about your project, it's clear that what you're doing is to a certain extent related to the notion of an indigenous poetics as opposed to a Western poetics.
Sure.
I I want to ask you, in some sense, because I'm not sure I totally agree with the way you oppose truth, because in some sense everything you say about what for you distinguishes the notion of tradition within the Urdu context is, in some sense, it seems to me, almost identically applicable to the very Western tradition that you claim it is not present in. So that, I mean, for instance, in fact, that your very title, Compound, is actually taken from Confucius and from the Eastern or ancient figure. But also that if your system works upon the basis of literary illusion as a sign of tradition, Pound's canto is open with a direct allusion to Homer, and Milton opens with a direct allusion to so on. So I'm kind of lost in terms of what the precise difference is, but I really don't quite see it.
Yes, in fact, I think I did mention something about T.S. Eliot, but I said that one of the more important and one of the more sort of exciting things that was seen to be happening in the wasteland was the poet was completely au fait in so many traditions and was able to allude to different kinds of poetic works. And then I made the point that this was considered to be an exciting new development, whereas in my poetry, this is considered to be part of the course. You do it all the time.
Okay, in a sense, that's what I'm questioning. So I don't see that that's actually true, since that it seems to me that almost every, at least every major poet you define has done precisely that in within the Western tradition. So I'm not quite sure about that sense of Eliot as being in some sense exceptional. Footnotes were certainly exceptional.
I can only say that whatever I learned about T.S. Eliot in my time, which was of course much before your time, and by that time people have learned more, I'm sure, was this, that he and Pound were doing something new in the Western tradition. And in fact, they kind of inaugurated a certain kind of school of study of poetry, where this was taken as a strong starting point. And so people became sort of wise after the event. What I want to say is that in this tradition, that is my tradition, this was a conscious part of the poetic activity. I mean, it's quite possible for you to read, say, for example, Shakespeare and find allusions to Montaigne or whoever. But whether Shakespeare was doing it consciously as a part of a poetic tactics is the question that is very moot. And maybe he was, because until his time, of course, there was a certain amount of tradition available to him to fall back upon. But to use a much, much misused and much oft abused and phrase of T.S. Eliot about the sensibilities, dissociation, I think some such break did occur in the Western tradition. Whereas in this tradition, this was the foundation. And the other difference, I think, is that whereas in the Western tradition, a poet's richness of allusion and his sense of the past being present, to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, was considered to be, what shall I say, considered to be a prescription for making poems, but it didn't guarantee that the poem would become a good poem just because the poet was doing this. I mean, he had to have something more. But in this system, you see, it's like our prosody. That to use a bad word, it is almost mechanical. That you can generate meters from 1 meter, and you can predict immediately what a meter is going to be and what you can generate from it. And you can state a poem's meter almost to the maximum possible, mathematical certainty and precision. So this was reduced to, or enlarged to, you can say, to a mechanical procedure. It became so much internalized. Whereas in the case of the Western, at least the modern Western tradition, say beginning from the 17th century onwards, it was seen as a good device. But whether this good device per se is able to make poems, they couldn't say it, in fact they can't say it. All that they could say is, look, like Pound, for example, alright, let's quarry other sources, let's go elsewhere and find something else. But whether by creating a jumble of various images borrowed from wherever you can borrow them from, you can make poems. Whereas here, because the mazmoon is intrinsic to the poem, You see, a poem is based on the mazmoon, and therefore you have an intrinsic thing available. You have, in to use again a modern sort of trendish word, you have signifiers available from which now it's up to you how many signifiers you can create. And the moment you are able to see connections between signifiers and signifieds, you are making a poem, which is more than what your Western tradition can say, at least to my understanding.
So, I mean, how would the mazmoon be, for instance, different to, let's say, the notion of the beloved in Western poetry?
No, you see, a mazmoon subsumes other things also, apart from the one notion of the beloved as, going back to the Pramasals, for example, that the beloved is unfindable and in a certain physical condition or social condition or whatever. Here, all experience, whatever experience you may have, that's why I am at pains to assert the power of contiguity here. That once you start thinking in terms of contiguity experiences, this and so this and so this and so this, so in theory you are able to encompass the entire experience of man. And it's not just the beloved, for example. As of course here we have taken a more easily accessible example of beloved and weeping, but as you can see in most of the shades, except for Khusrau, where the beloved has been mentioned specifically, and then again mentioned specifically in Nimat Khan Ali, in none of the shades there is a specific direct mention of the beloved as such. So it's not just one image or one figure somewhere directing the whole show from behind. It's that you are made to think in metaphors, and you are made to think in both kinds of metaphor, of substitution and contiguity, and thus create your own paradigms. Yes, there was somebody there at the back, I think, asking me a question.
Good.
Well, I'm not sure I want to get into this one, but let me try this on you. That in the Western tradition, the strongest, absolutely strongest signifier, if you want, if you want, is something from Homer, the Homeric simile, the Homeric or developed simile. We don't have it, we don't see it anyway, since I haven't, in my work with Sanskrit literature, I haven't seen the same type of, if you will, signifier, the poetic idea. Every reference on through our tradition, from Virgil, who made a very conscious reference to Homer and the Homeric simile. Every poet who has ever used this type of developed simile is making a reference back to Homer. It's the strongest thread in our tradition. As a matter of fact, it's always a very self-conscious and in a way self-reflective reference. Virgil, Milton, Spencer, and even down, you can take 20th century literature to refine it and even look like Homeric simile, you'll see that it is somehow or other referencing that. Lately, the thing that comes to mind is something that Anthony Powell, in years ago, wrote, was asking at the time, was clearly a Homeric form. And how would you, I don't know if that refers to what you're dealing with here, but this, it seems to me, is something where the reference drives that as far as we can in our quote, tradition. And in this case, it's similar. We've made a simile into something in many cases because of the power of the Homeric simile, something more powerful often than the metaphor.
Yes.
I'm not sure if that's a question or just throwing out another problem.
I it's quite true that the Homeric simile does survive in Western literature in some sense or the other. But my formulation is that the Homeric simile, of course, scholars will look into it from the point of view of the oral formulaic mode of composition and so forth, because it signals, you see, a certain kind of passage and so on. But actually, the main problem is that I am not aware of any formulation in Western poetics which says that by using Homeric simile in whatever creative way you can make a poem. All that you have is some sort of a marker that, all right, I have an access to this particular thing, and if maybe I can use it in some passage somewhere, I will be able to sort of show a certain creative departure. But per se, the simile, the Homeric simile, will not make a poem. Here, the new thing that we did was, of course, certainly building upon the Arabic and the Iranian tradition, The new thing was that we designated the concept of mazmoon as the basic fundamental bricks on which from which you make poems. The moment you hit a good mazmoon, you can be sure of being able to make a poem. And of course, subject to various other considerations, grammatical and so forth. Which is the main difference, I think?
It seems to me that the question of how tradition functions within a literature, say between English and Urdu, and the question of Urdu having an indigenous poetics are two different things. So that even if someone were to argue that tradition functions the same way in English literature as in Urdu, and I think in Harold Bloom, for example, does the type of tracing of influence that he does is in many ways very similar to this, although on the level of whole poems. And in that sense, a mana or a mazmoon would be something like, take immortality in for the theme of mortality and immortality in Ode to a Nightingale, and how some later poet deals with this same theme, and you can see the correspondence between the two poems and what the later poet is doing differently. But on the other hand, I don't think even if whether there is an analogy between the function of tradition, I don't think that would mean that Urdu, Persian, and Arabic don't have their own indigenous poetic.
I don't think. Mm-hmm. I just want to know.
Any other question?
I wanted to ask a question. I'm not terribly familiar with Urdu poetry, but I was also interested in the connection with the name of Jagannatha, and I was thinking about Rasa Dosha and the false, contiguity that you cannot make within, say, Sanskrit verse, or that the Alankarika say that you can't make, or should not be made, yet you've run across them. Are there certain contiguities within mazmoon which are just not allowed, like you can make this and this and this, but don't make
this? That's a good question. In fact, this is a question that I have been sort of trying to grapple with in my effort to understand khayal bandi as against mazmoon afrini, because the term khayal bandi has been used for wild kind of poets, within quotes, the poets who are out to make novelty and their object. Or so actually, whether mazmoon afrini, khayal bandi is nothing but a debased kind of mazmoon afrini, or it's an activity in its own right, is a question.